If you've been tuning in, then you know we've been celebrating National Poetry Month throughout April by bringing you a number of diverse voices. But April is also Jazz Appreciation Month. Often called America's classical music or the only true American art form, jazz today is a music that could probably use a little more appreciation. In the 1930s and 40s, when swing was king, jazz was popular on the radio and the dance floor. But as jazz became more about listening than dancing, the audience shrunk, and now some jazz fans worry that the music they love is being pushed to the margins of the musical world. But jazz fans are a passionate bunch, and they can often tell you exactly how they got that way. So we decided to ask NPR's Tom Cole. He's written a post for NPR's weekly online music series, Take Five, about the five jazz records that made him a fan. Tom, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you get into jazz?
Well, I was mostly into rock and roll and blues, acoustic blues, and there was a particular record store here in Washington where I grew up that I would go to, and one day I just decided to ask the jazz buyer to educate me. And so that's how I got started. His name was Thomas Paul. Everybody called him TP, and
he took to his task.
He did.
Did he have kind of a set curriculum, as it were, to introduce people? Or did he just size you up and think, this is what this guy would like?
I think it was more the latter. It was definitely not what you would call a sort of standard jazz primer. No New Orleans jazz, no Louis Armstrong, no Duke Ellington. He picked five records that I think meant something to him and that he thought I might like.
Well, let's start with this one. Okay. Bird and Diz, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie.
That was a record that dates from around about 1950. And from someone who was listening to rock and roll and blues, the speed of it and the intensity of it just knocked me out. I mean, the first tune on the record is Bloom Dito, but the tune that I picked for us to hear is Relaxin' with Lee, which is a little bit of a slower tune. But right off the top, you can hear that distinctive Charlie Parker alto saxophone sound. It's just, whenever I hear him, and I think, you know, a lot of jazz fans, you can just immediately say that's Bird.
What else do you like about it?
The voice. He's talking to you. I mean, it's just, you can hear right in the beginning, just the short phrases. And it really is like a human voice speaking through an instrument.
Okay, what's number two on your hit parade?
In no particular order, the second one that TP gave me was a recording by Eric Dolphy and Booker Little. Eric Dolphy, another great alto saxophonist. And again, with him, you can sort of hear that voice coming through the instrument. He's playing the same instrument as Charlie Parker, alto saxophone. And yet, you can just hear him sort of speak. It's a very distinctive sound. He sounded like no one else, obviously influenced by Charlie Parker, but at the same time taking it way further, and just the stories that I remember about, you know, reading about them as I got more and more into it. Eric Dolphy was the kind of guy where, you know, at a party of musicians and fans or whatever, he'd always be the one over by the record player listening and changing the records.
That's great. Well, let's play. What are you going to play for us? What have you chosen to hear?
The tune is Fire Waltz. It's the first tune on the record. This was recorded live at the Five Spot in New York in 1961. Hear a little bit of crowd ambience to start things off, and then, you know, Dolphy and Booker Little start right out playing the theme, and then Dolphy takes the first solo.
All right, here it is. And once again, that's from Live at the Five Spot, Volume one. I love the coughing at the beginning. I don't know why I love that so much.
Like, and then you hear one of them, I think maybe it's Dolphy saying, you know, all right, Mal Waldron. And so you hear Waldron sort of start out. He was the pianist on the record.
The next album, 2 Hours with Thelonious. That's a name that a lot of people will know.
This was a 2-LP set. This was back in the days when there were LPs. 2-LP set of compilations of live recordings that Thelonious Monk did in Europe. I think it was on his first trip to Europe, and with a classic quartet that included saxophonist Charlie Rouse, who I would like to say was born right here in Washington, D.C. And 2 Hours with Thelonious, the one that I picked for the website was Epistrophe, and the reason that I picked it just in listening to it is the way Charlie Rouse comes in on the saxophone, and you sort of hear, again, his voice. It's a different voice from Parker's or Dolphy's. But then you sort of hear the group kind of lock in, John Orr playing bass and Frankie Dunlop playing drums. And then Rouse starts to play with the time a little bit, and he's not like right on the beat. And then you listen to Monk, and he's sort of behind him doing these funny little things. And the thing that grabbed me about these particular things, not so much the virtuosity or the speed or anything, because, you know, with Monk's music, it's very angular, it's a lot of it is about the composition, was the sort of cohesion of the group.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm visiting with NPR's Tom Cole. He's talking about the 5 records that got him into jazz. And then we have Better Get It In Your Soul. That's just fun to say. What
sure.
did you like about this?
Sure. This was, Mingus quickly became one of my favorites, and I think this is probably
be Charles Mingus or Charlie Mingus, as most people call
Charles Mingus, I think, is Mingus. What he preferred to
is
be
what
called.
He preferred to be called,
he
yes,
was,
sir.
He was very particular. He was an interesting man. He could be, as I understand it, difficult to work with, but just a brilliant composer. I mean, some people will say he was coming right out of Ellington and carrying the whole compositional aspect of jazz to the next level. And the tune that I picked, Better Get It In Your Soul, starts out with Mingus playing the bass, very rhythmic, very, you know, something just immediately catches you and draws you in. And then the ensemble comes in with John Handy playing alto saxophone, Booker Irvin tenor saxophone, Jimmy Nepper trombone, and it just moves.
You also wrote in your piece that the liner notes are great, interviews with the players, Mr. Charles Mingus, his funny set, backstory, plus you can actually read them without a magnifying glass on the big gatefold double LP. That's always a plus.
No, definitely.
And you said also that the title tune kicks off and still comes into your head, even if you haven't listened to it in a while.
Oh, sure. Sometimes that ba-da-da-da-bum, ba-da-da-da-bum. I mean, yeah, I hear that. The other great thing about that is you hear Mingus in the background going, oh, yeah. And if you listen carefully, you can hear him sort of like reciting the title. Better Get It In Your Soul.
And what's your final album? Your final.
The final one, embarrassingly, I couldn't remember the 5th record, but I picked one that I think might have been among them.
Okay.
It's one that I know I bought at Discount Records, at this record store that I would go to. And it's the Art Ensemble of Chicago, Les Stances à Sophie. It means stanzas for Sophie or stanzas to Sophie. Again, this opens with Malachi Favor's driving bass and just a solid rhythm. And I think, you know, maybe TP knew that I was a rock and roller and, you know, it was all about rhythm and punch and... There it is, Don Moyer's drums. It's just a great record.
That was from Les Stances et Sophie. Is there something, Tom, that you think links all of these albums?
I think in some senses it's the intensity of them, the emotional intensity, which, you know, even for a non-jazz listener, caught my ear in the early 1970s, someone who was used to listening to rock and roll or blues. There is something there that if you give yourself to it, if you just sort of like sit down and listen, you can connect to. And it connected with me, the honesty, the intensity, the emotion, the human aspect of it, the way the musicians are in some senses sort of speaking directly to you.
You know, I noticed you know a lot about these guys. And I have to say that is one of the things that intimidates me about jazz. It's almost like baseball. I mean, I can just go to a game and watch the game, but baseball fans know so much about it. Sometimes I kind of feel like a little intimidated.
You know, you shouldn't, and you're exactly right. It is just like baseball. People know who played with whom, when, you know, and then when they went to another team and all of that stuff. It should just be about the music. I guess because it's part of the indoctrination that you do sort of, you know, once you sort of fall into the scene, then everybody talks about who played with who when. But then all of that stuff should just go to the side and you should just listen and hear what you can and don't worry about the rest.
Okay. So finally, Tom, do you think we need Jazz Appreciation Month?
I guess it helps. I guess it helps raise awareness. I think in the end, maybe it's up to jazz to continue to try to make new sounds rather than, I think we're perhaps in a period now where a number of musicians spend a lot of time looking backwards instead of forwards. I don't know quite how to put it. I don't know whether or not you can be honest if you're sort of living in 2009 and playing like you were in 1955. Because music doesn't exist in a vacuum. It responds to its time. And we're living in a particular time now, and the music should speak to that.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with NPR's Tom Cole. Tom's story is part of NPR Music's weekly series on jazz called Take Five. You can learn more about jazz and hear songs from all five records that got Tom into jazz at nprmusic.org. Tom, thanks again.
Thank you.